This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
There's no better feeling than a personal win, and the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Shouldn't you be at work?
It's a lovely chip! Oh, it's a brilliant goal from Lord Bohinen!
Still, it's not away. Southgate shot. Milosevic scores.
DPR could do with a bit of magic from him. Maybe this is it. It is! Andy Sinton from nothing.
Brian Roy has headed Forest into the lead.
Whelan. Oh, what a goal from Noel Whelan.
No power on it whatsoever. But Taibbi has made a horrendous error.
Now, you know him better than anybody, probably. Do you back him to score quickly, yes or no?
Yes.
Oh, and it hasn't.
No.
Hello and welcome to Series 11, Episode 5 of Quickly Kevin Willey Score. It's another big one. Joining me, as always, Josh Whittacombe.
Hello.
And dancing in the moonlight. It's Michael Martin.
Hello.
I just wanted to get a top loader. Do you think we're going to pick up many top loader fans coming in for this one?
Is that 90s?
Why is
this dancing in the moonlight 90s?
Well, it's a cover, isn't it? It's probably pre 90s. But Dion Dublin, of course, playing with top loader.
Yeah, of course.
But probably what he's most famous for, behind Coventry, Aston Villa, and Holmes Under the Hammer.
The other top loader thing is that there was a thing doing the rounds, wasn't there, of Liz Truss when she was young being interviewed in the NME as a new MP, and her favourite album was Onker's Big Mocker by Top Loader.
Really?
Yeah.
That can't be the case anymore, can it?
I can't imagine she's popped it on in 10 Downing Street. Partly because of obviously what happened within 24 hours of her getting the job. Right.
Did I ever tell you, last time we talked about Top Loader, I looked up their set list and they played Dancing in the Moonlight twice.
If anything, too little. So, shall we get on with the 90s o'clock news?
Yes, please.
From the headquarters of ITN, News at 10, with Chris Scull.
All the latest news from the 2021 Meat Management Industry Awards.
Oh, yes, please.
And David Beckham's contract at Preston North End emerges. Should we talk about the Meat Management Industry Awards? Because, shout out to Rhys Daly, who sent this one in. They've published the highlights from the Meat Management Awards 2021. There's a video. Kevin Keegan speaks in the video.
Oh, wow.
Boy, are you in for a treat. So Keegan only appears a couple of times in this video.
Yeah.
Just seeing that introduction, I can't wait to hear myself speak now. I'll be honest with you.
Keegan comes on, he makes some quip about who's talked about it, who's been on the guest who's been on before him. But then you see Keegan delivering a talk.
But it's over music.
It's over music. You can't hear any of the content.
Keegan walks on, as we've just heard, I'm sure, and says, after hearing that intro, I'm looking forward to my self-talk now. I'd love to hear the intro. Presumably, the words European Footballer of the Year were certainly used in that intro. But I think what's happened there is Keegan's got a corporate set, understandably, and he doesn't want any of it used in the video. So, which I totally understand. Keegan's not including his material in the video. So, yeah. That's what's happened there, surely.
Okay, but I can play you in the last bit. So there's a little interview at the end of the video with Kevin Keegan.
Yeah, I really enjoyed myself. I've never been to anything to do with the meat industry before. I do a lot of work like this, but yeah, the great crowd. For me, the biggest pleasure I got was the joy on the faces of the winners. You know, it's lovely to win things and to see what they've done for the last year has been recognised.
How middle of the road is
that? Oh, my word. I don't believe that Kevin Keegan thought about the joy on the face of the winners at the Meat Marketing Industry Awards ever again after leaving. But, you know, of course he's got to say something. I don't begrudge him that answer, because I think he's dealt with a situation of trying to offer an opinion on something he couldn't give a shit about very easily.
And it's great as well, he's kept the spirit of the entertainers, because it's great to win something. It's great to win something. And he's happy to see the joy on their faces. He's all about entertaining football and entertaining meat management.
I wonder whether that's the... This is a new attitude after he lost the 1996 title race. Because surely Keegan should be more impressed with the nominees who put in a more exciting loin of pork that maybe wasn't as effective.
You see him as well doing the round. You see him in the video, again, no sound, but you see him doing the rounds and kind of like checking into the table. Do you think he's just consoling the runners-up, going, you've got to learn from this?
I wonder if he doesn't. I would love... Surely, if he's running through all the awards, he's got to do a pastiche at some point.
When he says something like that about Lincolnshire sausages, I'll tell you. Do you know the most astonishing bit as well is at the start he goes, I've never done anything with the meat industry before. Then why are you here? But again, I don't understand why you've been booked. You've got no association with the meat industry.
You've said he has lots of... He's been very clear in the promotional literature last series we covered that he does have a lot of barbecues. I think that's...
So next up, David Beckham's contract at Preston North End has come into the public domain. So this is astonishing. This came into the public domain because it's actually the stadium manager's office at Deepdale. The actual contract is framed and on the wall of the manager. So it's quite a cool little piece of history. So you can see what David Beckham's contract there. So he was getting...
So who was paying... Were Preston paying all of his wages?
I think this is the contact between Preston and Manchester United, right, maybe. Okay. So you can see that David Beckham is earning £400 a week and £50 if he scores. This is February 1995.
Wow. That's a high goal bonus, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And I think he scored a few times. I think he played... Where is it? Let's have a look here. I've got the actual stats somewhere. He made 5 appearances in Division 3, scoring 2 goals.
Good scoring record, better than Paolo Di Canio's. Yeah. It's a higher ratio than Paolo Di Canio. If you were a Preston fan, or are a Preston fan, if you saw those games, I'd love to know how he did. I'd love a scouting report on how David Beckham did in his Preston time. An honest appraisal of what you thought as a Preston fan of David Beckham when he played for you in the early to mid-90s.
Well, I don't know much of his Preston time. Yeah, I'd love to know that. But I do know that while he was at Preston, he scored from a corner.
Did he?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
I would like to expand that out and say, if you're a fan of a lower league club and a kind of a big 90s football player played for you on loan when they were young, not later in their career, when they were young, when no one knew who they were, you're sort of honest... perspective on it.
Yeah, I don't think we had anyone like that at Plymouth. But the best goal I ever saw in the flesh was scored by a loanee at Plymouth, and that was Scott Sinclair, who did go on to a high level, I'd say. He ran from the edge of the Plymouth area all the way up to score. It was away at Barnet. And Scott Sinclair was obviously better than everyone else when he played for Plymouth. But that's the only
experience. Would you say he's the best... The best player ever to play for Plymouth, like in terms of what he's gone on to do. No, in the modern era, I mean.
Obviously, we've had players go the other way. Dan Gosling, maybe? He did all right. Mark Edworthy played quite a lot at the top level.
These aren't very good names.
Jamie Mackey. Jamie Mackey played in the Aguero game, I think he probably played in.
Surely, right, like, there's enough footballers, someone good would have come through.
I think it's more of a sign of how difficult it is to transition from the lower two divisions into the Premier League. How rare it is that someone would play in those divisions these days.
Leighton Orient had Harry Kane. Do you know what I mean?
That's one example. That's literally the only example we've got, Chris. That's literally it. You're 10 seconds away from saying the words Jamie Vardy to back it up.
I'd love to know, maybe there's a kind of best player at the worst club thing that maybe that
I mean, and your scouting reports on 90s legends that played for you when they were lower, do send them in. Now Here is the electronic postbag.
I'm Jim Rosenthal, and this is the electronic postbag.
You've got mail.
We stay, don't worry, on a sideways kind of reference to Plymouth, which is Peter Shilton's assistant, John McGovern. Do you remember John McGovern? Played in the Brian Clough European Cup winning Forest team. I think he might have played for Derby under him as well. Yeah. One of the main stars of that. Now, do you remember last week's Antti Niemi clip, or a couple of weeks ago, I can't remember now, in which a man phoned up a radio station to ask why Antti Niemi wasn't in the Scotland team? Well, this has been revealed about John McGovern. John McGovern, who won two European Cups at Forest, but was never capped for Scotland. And do you know why? Well, get this. So, Ali McLeod, the manager for the Argentina 1978 World Cup, said, after Forest beat Man U 4-0 at Old Trafford, Ali McLeod said that all the Scottish players at Forest would be in the squad for Argentina. A photographer went down to Nottingham, hired kilts, and got John Robertson, Archie Gemmell, Kenny Burns into those kilts, along with Brian Clough, for a photograph. Yeah. And then the squad was named, and John McGovern wasn't in the Scotland squad. And do you know why? Because Ali McLeod didn't realise he was Scottish.
So what?
Jeez.
So that meant he didn't get picked?
Didn't get picked because the manager of Scotland didn't realise that John McGovern was a Scot.
I just don't understand that, because surely his teammates are going, you know, John's from like Montrose, whoever it is.
The squad was named and I wasn't there. Somebody asked him about that and he said he didn't know I was Scottish. Isn't that mad?
That makes no sense. He's really good. He's got to be one of the best Scottish players. Do you know what? I've just looked. He played twice for the under-23s for Scotland.
Yeah, so that
did
was
Did everyone
under...
who's witnessed that just forget it? Forgot it happened, you know?
Well, no, just Ali McLeod. Just Ali McLeod, the manager, was naming the squad. You're not Googling... I suppose it's a kind of sign of how much things were just done on the... scribble on the back of a kind of... notepad or whatever.
Yeah, you'd be livid though, wouldn't you? There's no sort of Football Manager, you know, player search by nationality. You'd be so annoyed. Imagine missing out on a World Cup or a major tournament because your national team manager just doesn't know your nationality.
But sure, can't you phone him up? Even it's, in the 70s.
Especially like looking forward to how like Jack Charlton and those Republic of Ireland people found players generations like away, the tenuous link. This guy's actually Scottish.
He's in the Scottish Football Hall of Fame.
Yeah, exactly.
Which he shouldn't be because he didn't play enough.
He wasn't at the time, to be very clear. That is amazing, isn't it?
He's one of only two Scottish players to ever win the European Cup but never get a full international cap.
Who's the other?
He said, I've got a quote from John McGovern. I would have walked up the M74 over broken glass to get one cap for Scotland. I just wish I'd have got one cap because that would have been the proudest moment of my life. That is
even when he doesn't take him to the World Cup, surely someone mentions it and then he gets picked after that. Like,
this is incredible.
Or like there's qualifiers.
He played for Nottingham Forest until 1982.
Yeah, like a game or a couple of games not getting picked. But in the run-up, you know, let's just say there's four squad announcements prior to the main World Cup squad announcement. Surely somebody, as a journalist, a manager, a player, goes, hey, boss, what about McGovern? We're a bit light in midfield. Or, you know, why didn't you pick him? There are two or three other players, you said, at his own club being picked. Yeah. Why didn't one of them go... is there a, you know, just so I can tell my mate back home, why is he not picked?
Yeah, if you're John McGovern, you're going to the your mates, who's it, Archie Gemmell and Asa Hartford. Could you have a word? Like, you'd think Brian Clough would pick up the phone for him.
Well, maybe Clough didn't. Do you think he might have, like, is he famously, like, he didn't like his players, you know, he didn't want to big him up too much. Do you think his head would have gone if it had been called up? I don't know. This
maybe Clough put a word in Ali McLeod's ear saying, you know, he's actually English.
He's a bad egg. And he's English. He's one of those English bad eggs. That is astonishing. I feel so sad for him.
Do email in. It feels so not true that please email in if we're wrong. And not we're wrong. John McGovern himself is wrong. Because we're not peddling this. Ben Parkin. Hello, chaps. Having just come back from school's National Athletics Final and reading their programme, I was shocked to see a former 90s footballer. as one of the competition record holders. So, one of the record holders for the school triple jump is Mr. Michael Dewberry.
What?
Yeah, you know how we were talking on the Danny Baker Own Goals and Gaffes episode, if you are a fan club member, about natural talent? I suppose Michael Dewberry is a great example of that natural talent because he is a record holder in the triple jump. Here it is.
Wow.
So the Intermediate Boys Schools Cup Final, best ever performances. Triple jump. M. Dewberry, Enfield Grammar, Middlesex. Do you want to have a guess? In 1991, so that would be about when he was at school. That is the correct time. Do you want to have a guess what Michael Dewberry was jumping in the triple jump?
So what's the... Jonathan Edwards is doing, what, 18 metres,
18 metres, Jonathan Edwards.
So I'm going to go 16.
Michael?
I think that's quite long. I'm going to say 15.2.
14.17.
Oh!
Which, if you saw the triple jump at my school when we did it... Like, the distance Dewberry was beating people in my school at the triple jump.
I was so bad at triple jump that I wouldn't make the sand pit. Joe, like, you'd start and you'd go, I can't jump onto my ass because I'm going to land on rubber. Like, it's so short, I can't even get to the sand pit.
Do you want another quick quiz question before we wrap up the postbag from Graham McKenzie? How many games did Roger Miller start in the 1990 World Cup?
Oh, here we go. I love stuff like this.
One.
None. He didn't start again.
He didn't start.
He still managed to score four goals. He's one of the most memorable players of the tournament. He played 241 minutes in total as a sub over five matches, two of which involved extra time. Group stage, 10 minutes versus Argentina. 32 minutes for Romania, two goals scored. 57 minutes versus Soviet Union, didn't score. Last 16, 67 minutes, including extra time. Two goals scored against Colombia. Quarterfinal came on at half-time, played 75 minutes against England. There we go.
So the Soviet Union game, was that a group game?
Yeah.
So he's come on before half-time in that game.
He's come on before half-time.
Unless there were 8 or 9 minutes of additional time.
Maybe there was an injury. Let's have a look. It is mad that he never started. Was he that unfit that he couldn't run for a whole game? Oh, they lost 4-0 to the Soviet Union, so they were 2-0 down. It's mad, they lost 4-0. They had a good World Cup.
Wow.
He came on, at 2-0 after 34 minutes.
Maybe we're peeling back the layers of that George Weah myth about the volume of time that they sleep. So perhaps Roger Miller... The only way that he could play him and he'd be effective is he had to wake up at some point during the first half.
All great.
Otherwise, he wasn't getting his requisite amount of hours sleep.
All great African strikers are sleeping the George Weah amount of sleep. That's
astonishing. Great. It's a nice little fact. More of that.
More of all of it. If you want to get in touch, this is how.
Get in touch with the show. Email hello@quicklykevin.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Quickly Kevin, and sign up to the mailing list at quicklykevin.com.
Right, this next interview, I'm going to say it. It's straight into the Hall of Fame, this one, isn't it?
I love this so much. One of our best ever episodes. I know we say that sometimes, but this really is top tier, grade A Quickly Kevin.
I felt like we could have talked for another hour and every anecdote he had was still gold. Like, we weren't getting close to the dregs.
Yeah, I'd say Michael does a lot of work on some of these episodes to make it the enjoyable listen it is. But I would imagine, Michael, this has been a very light touch, if at all. If you want more of Dion Dublin, there is him answering the listeners' questions. So, the dube is mentioned. Head over to anotherslice.com/quicklykevin to join the fan club for more of Dion Dublin, plus all our extra episodes on there and extended versions of all our other episodes, plus lots and lots of other perks. anotherslice.com/quicklykevin. But here is a man who bestrode the 90s high and low, from Cambridge to Manchester United to following Paul Gascoigne into the room when... dropped from the 1998 England squad. This is the incredible Dion Dublin.
Our guest this week is a titan of 90s football, the star of many a Cambridge United, Coventry City and Aston Villa side. But you'll know him best as the inventor of the Jube and the breakout star of Homes Under the Hammer. Welcome to Quickly Kevin, Dion Dublin.
How are we? That is some intro, by the way. Let me
I've got to ask right off the top. How did you get into Homes Under the Hammer? How does this happen?
And you know what it was? You know, by mistake, in 1992, when I signed for United, in 92, I bought a house in Cheshire. And then obviously things didn't go well for me at United with a broken leg and stuff. So I had to leave, but I kept hold of a house. And then I went to Coventry and I bought a house in Warwickshire. And then I bought another house in Warwickshire, but I kept hold of the houses. And before I know it, I thought, Aye, they're putting a few quid in for me here. I'll keep hold of those. And then three houses in, before you know it, you know, you've got yourself a little portfolio. And when I was at Coventry, Villa and Leicester, I could stay in Warwickshire. So it was nice that I could manage them quite easily. So
you weren't managing them yourself, though. You're not phoning up your landlord, Dion Dublin, because your heater's broken, are you? Your boiler's not there. Working. I know you've got a game tomorrow, Dion, but...
Can't hear you. Boiler's down. It's early on, pal, I was, but now I've got some friends that are helping me out.
Right.
Which is good.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Today Healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways Healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Well, let's start with football. We always ask this of professional footballers. How much better were you than everyone else at school?
I started playing seriously. This sounds stupid. About nine years old.
Yeah,
It's late, isn't it?
Yeah, it is late. Exactly. When I say started playing seriously, people started to think, "Oh, wait a minute, he's scoring a couple of goals for the school team."
Yeah.
So I started under 10s at Leicester, Leicester City, and I was playing for the county. And every time you score a goal, your name gets in the paper, and then I cut it out and then I save it and put it in my scrapbook. And I've got loads of scrapbooks from that era. But from nine, in answer to your question, I was, you know, you score a lot of goals in the kids' teams and you're shooting from the halfway line, the keeper comes out, it bounces over his head, you score six in a game, you won 18-0, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then you progress, and then as you're playing for Leicester City, 10s, 11s, 12s, 13s, you just get better and you get bigger and you get taller. And I don't know, you always stay ahead of the people around you if you're doing the work to do so. And I just kept going. And when I got to 15, everything kind of stopped at Leicester. Leicester said, "You're not quite good enough here. We're going to have to let you go." And then I had to work for a year. I knew that. Even saying it now, I get a bit of a nosebleed. Work. After work, I had to do a proper job. I had to do 80 hours. It's just crazy. Crazy. And I was doing, I worked in a leisure centre, putting out the badminton gear and stuff. And I worked in a hosiery factory, wrapping up fabrics. Worked in an ice cream factory, which wasn't bad, to be fair, for the family. That. So I did like a year's worth of work. And while I was doing that, this is how I started. This is how my career started. While I was doing that, my dad wrote a letter, literally wrote a letter. He photocopied it 92 times. Put it in envelopes, wrote the address of every single professional football club, put a stamp on it, and sent 92 letters out to every single professional club saying, my son's really good, he can do this, he can do that. Got about 10 replies, got about 6 trials, and then away you go.
Wow. So do you think there's a parallel world in which you weren't a footballer? Or do you think with players of... I mean, you played for England. Surely it feels inevitable that you'd have made a living from it, right?
Yeah, I don't know. If you don't have... I know it's very, very much cliche. If you don't have your mum and dad's car as the taxi to take trials and all this kind of stuff. My mum and dad worked their arses off, man. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There was me, 3 brothers and a sister, and we all lived in this terrace house on a council estate in Leicester, and they worked and worked and worked, and they ferried me around the country for trials and football matches and stuff, and they were knackered. But they allowed me to, and I was the youngest, to be fair. I think actually what they were thinking, the other 3 brothers were shit. I need to make sure you bring the dough in, young man. Get yourself to
it. when your dad's writing those letters, because you're a bit of a curiosity in football, because you're famously striker/defender, obviously more known as a striker. Where are you playing back then?
I was playing centre forward, a bit of a glory hunter, scoring goals, and on the odd occasion I'd have to go and play centre half for the team. I was playing men's football at 15 while I was working in the ice cream factory and all that stuff. So I was playing men's football, getting kicked up in the air all the time. But, you know, football wise, I was fine, but very light physically and stuff. So I was getting smashed all over the place, which I think took me in the direction of being a physical player. So you had to look after yourself at 15. You were light. You were getting smashed every week by the guys that had been to the pub on the Saturday night, absolutely steaming on the Sunday, and they just want to kick the young lad. And I was the young lad. And it made me know how to deal with pain, how to fall, how to take, you know, contact. And that's how I think I sort of mapped out the game that I played, which was obviously a very physical game.
And playing a physical game, the best place to be in the country at the start of your career, I would say, was Cambridge United. That was pretty much the philosophy, right?
Honestly, we had, I don't know, about 5 or 6 seniors in that squad. We had a player called Liam Daish.
Yeah, went to Birmingham.
Liam Daish, Birmingham, left-sider, left-side, centre-half, unit, hard Irishman, didn't want to cross him. We had so many unnecessary scraps in the tunnel down to Daish. Obviously, there was so many things that you don't know about, what was this, late 80s, early 90s. And Daish is going down, he's got the armband on, and he just wants to fight everybody, and he gets, what are you fucking looking at? And then it all just fucking, and you, big cloud, honestly, a big cloud in the tunnel, and you come out the tunnel, and everybody's got nose and eyes, all over that kind of stuff, and there's blood everywhere, and the game ain't even started. But that's what we were like, one in all in, you know? It was just, I think that's what made me, absolutely spot on. I went from this skinny young boy to, you know, a man. When I came out, I was ready. I was ready to go, you know, with anything. And it was down to characters like Daishi, Christian Edgbutter, Tony Dennis, Gary Clayton. Loads and loads of good characters, man. And even now, they're the ones, you know, that I keep in touch with.
Chris Leadbitter, of course, played in the 1996 playoff final. Plymouth beat Darlington. I'm sure that was a big day that you knew I'd bring up. Gary Clayton was in that squad as well, but we won't go into that. A big man in this, the biggest man in this whole kind of tale of Cambridge, you know, let's say the greatest period in the history of Cambridge United was John Beck, who is a legend of this podcast. We're obsessed with him. What was he like? Was he scary?
He wasn't scary at all. He was odd in the way that he wanted us to play the game. Because the manager that took me to Cambridge was a guy called Chris Turner. God rest his soul, he's no longer with us. However, he knew the game, and all the players that I've mentioned to you, Liam Daish, Chris Leadbitter, he brought all those players into the club. He had us for about a year. He wanted us to play out from the back, and he wasn't a coach, but he was very much a manager, a good man manager. And Becky was our number 2. He was a first team coach. And then below Becky was Gary Johnson. And below Gary Johnson was a guy called Graham Scarfe. So we had some really good coaches. Chris Turner was with us for about a couple of years, and then John Beck took over. Change. Everything changed. Don't you be playing out from that, none of that tippy-tappy stuff. Get it on your back. Smash it down the channel onto Dion Dublin's head, John Taylor's head, or Stevie Claridge's head, and chase after it. And we'll work off stats. And that's what it was. It was just, he changed everything.
What was training like under him? Was it literally that?
It was just the same as the game. What he did as well, I don't know if you know this, if you can imagine, I'm centre-half right now, and then on the right of me is the right-back, Gary Clayton. So Gary Clayton's there, and you've got the left-back over there. Down those channels of the right-back and the left-back, at the far end of the pitch, there was a sign. And this is no joke, there was a sign. He had made some massive sign, and it said, Quality Street. And all they had to do, just hit Quality Street, out your right foot, bam. Out your right foot, bam. If nobody's there, you still have to kick it up that street. It was just crazy.
So there's some myths about John Beck that I'll be able to answer.
I bet you they're not myths. I bet you they're
So one's a bit like Quality Street, is that he'd grow the grass longer in the corner to hold up the ball.
No myth.
That's true.
Really? How much longer is the grass in the corner? Is it like boggy?
Quite long. So what happens is you put on your right foot, you ping it in there, you put a bit of backspin on it, it hits the long grass, it stops, and then Mickey Cheatham gets on the end of it and crosses it, or Phil Pott gets on the end of it and crosses it, and by that time it gives us old men time to get in the box. Honestly, all that. Give us another one, Josh.
He tactically repositioned the away team dugout.
There you go. Unbelievable. Closer to the noise of our fans.
Really?
Closer to the noise of the intimidating main fans of Cambridge. Absolutely mental. The other thing, the things that you might not know about, which are beneath the bowels of the main stand, is that when they turned up, if it was a sunny day at Cambridge United, I don't know if you've ever been to Cambridge, but you go underneath the main stand and then you turn left into the dressing rooms under the main stand.
Yeah.
If it was a hot day, we'd make sure the windows couldn't open.
Really?
If it was a cold day, the windows would be open. Honestly, all this is absolutely true.
Brilliant.
The other thing as well is back in the day, you used to get those big, massive tea urns where you can just, massive silver, massive industrial teapots. We'd make them a nice pot of tea, but we'd put like two or three bags of sugar in it. So that they'd get this and then they'd crash, you know, after about 15 minutes. And we did that as well. One of the main things was we'd give them no hot water ever. Yeah. And the other thing as well, back in the day when you used to go play away games, the away team would give you a bag of balls to get warmed up with for the coaches.
Yeah.
Before they arrived, we would put all their balls in our big bath so they'd be absolutely heavy as anything. And then we put them in a bag and give them to them. The bag, as you're dragging the bag down the corridor, it's dripping water. They're smashing the ball. They start playing with a light ball at the start of the game. The ball's going all over the place.
He's a managerial genius, though. This is the marginal gains, right?
It was horrible to watch. But if you're a football fan and your team's horrible to watch, however, getting results...
And you don't care.
Getting to the quarterfinal of the FA Cup and you're, I don't know, getting in fourth division, third division, fans ain't going to moan. They are not going to moan. And they didn't.
Can I ask one more question? Did he throw buckets of cold water over you before the match?
Yes, he did.
Is that every game? Every game he's doing that?
That was started by Chris Turner. Chris Turner started that. It was an away game. We travelled on the morning of the game. It was either Carlisle or Cardiff, I cannot remember. But it was the morning of the game. We travelled 4 or 5 hours. We got there, we were shattered. We'd been on the coach for this long. And we had to get straight off the coach and go play the game. So I'll get cold showers, lads, cold showers. Get in the cold. What do you mean cold showers? Get in the cold showers. I'm not doing the cold shower. You're not playing then. So you get in the cold shower, 10 seconds, on, bam, cold, like that, shaken away. And as you stepped out of the shower, there was somebody waiting with a cold bucket of cold water. Over your face. It woke you up. It did the job, but, you know.
A great period in the history of Cambridge. It started when you scored the only goal in the playoff final in Division 4. What do you remember that day? Was that one of your greatest days in football, in a way?
Yes, 100%. I do remember that the build-up was great. I think we got to train a day or 2 days at the England Burnham Beaches, I think it was called back then.
Yeah.
So we got to train there, which was amazing. That was quite special for us.
First time at Burnham Beaches, where they've been going, hit quality straight, get it down.
And the pitches are level all over the place. There's no grass in the corners or anything. You've got to pass
it. No good.
Put it in the corners. You put it into quality, you just ran out. Just ran out for a goal kick every single time. But the experience of Wembley was amazing. You know, it was just, I can't, that's my first taste of the big time, I suppose.
Yeah.
Playoff final, third division playoff final against Chesterfield. Sean Dyche's mob, and we won the game 1-0. However, I remember Chrissy Leadbitter, you know, your hero there. He went over from left wing over to the right wing, took an in-swinging corner with his left foot.
Yeah.
I was on the far post. Stevie Clowes is on the near post. So Stevie's walk, as Chrissy's putting the ball down, he's getting himself ready and all that kind of stuff. Stevie comes to me and said, "Dion, get yourself on the near post." I said, No. I'm here, Stevie, I'm here. He said, "Dion, get yourself on the near," because Stevie's a little bit older than me, so senior, all that kind of stuff. I said, "Stevie, I'm staying here because this is my position." He said, "Fucking get on the near post." So Gaffer told you to get on the near post. All right, so we're on the near post. Chrissy crosses it, near post, Bosch, Dublin, 1-0. Thank you. Thank you, Steve Barrage.
It's Cambridge's corner. And it'll be swung in by Leadbitter towards Dublin, and Dion Dublin scores. 1-0 for Cambridge, and Dion Dublin, rising above the Chesterfield defence, has got the goal that could be so precious for Cambridge United's season. A firm header, the keeper had come off the line, and it went.
And given what you would go on to achieve in your career, like, were you finding it easy? Was it clear to you that you were better than this level back then?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. It wasn't. I don't think it was me as an individual that stood out. I think it was my goals that stood out. As I mentioned, Mickey Cheatham, Lee Philpott mainly are the ones that just crossed it, just allowed me to, you know, stay in the box. My job was easy. All I had to do is head it in left and right.
One of the things is you got two quarterfinals in the FA Cup in consecutive years. Do you think the teams higher up were scared of Cambridge? Was that how it was achieved?
Yeah, I don't think they were scared of Cambridge. I think they were scared of coming to the Abbey.
Right.
I think the Abbey was a horrible place to go, not the most glamorous ground in the world back then. We knew we had a little bit of a reputation of having six or seven horrible people in the side that leave a bit on you and, you know, for scrap. Liam Dace was 60-40 to get to the ball first, but he made it a 50-50 or a 45-55 out of his favour. So he could lift people. But that's what we just loved the contact, you know. It was just the way we were, and it's the way we won games, you know. People turned up at the Abbey and they thought, it's freezing in the dressing room, the balls are terrible. I've got a fix of sugar, I don't know what to do. and we played an ugly game of football, you know, and our fans just made noise. It was just the fact of going to Cambridge United, people didn't like it. We'd half won. Psychologically, we had an advantage.
I was watching footage of when it's February 91, you beat Sheffield Wednesday in the FA Cup. I don't know if you've watched this on YouTube, but
I've got on Betamax somewhere.
What happens is, so they show the highlights and then they cut back to Des in the Match of the Day studio, and he's got you and John Beck in the studio that evening. I'll be honest, you haven't got the confidence in front of the camera that you've got these days, Dion. Was that your first TV studio appearance? Do you remember it?
Yes, I do remember it. I remember talking very quickly and very short answers, and yeah, I left it to Becky to do most of the talking, but it was scary having just played the game and going on TV on a massive show like that. It was kind of scary. So that was my first big appearance.
How does it happen? Do they grab you after the game? Do they say, "Oh, do you fancy going on Match of the Day tonight"? How does it work?
Well, they spoke to Becky, and Becky said, "Listen, we'd like you and Dion to come on." And Becky said yes, and then he said, "Dion, you're going on." It was very much a you're doing as you're told, and that's what it was back then.
And then you go up through the leagues, and you're on the verge. You get to the playoffs. You get straight promotion. Also, Beck turns down a job at Leicester, saying he wanted to take Cambridge into the Premier League. Did you believe in the dressing room this would happen?
To a certain degree, we did. But as we the more we played, the more we realised we were okay as footballers. We weren't allowed to show it because of the way that Becky wanted us to play. Mm. But we knew if the more we went, the higher we went up in standard of football, the cleverer the player was, and the more that they would know, right, okay, let's just stand in the corner, Quality Street, because that's where it's going to go, and then we'll just back and they'll nullify everything that Cambridge want to do. And the more we did it, the higher we went up, the more difficult it became. And we knew that we had to change it a little bit in order to play a bit through the middle, but Becky wasn't having it and he wouldn't change and we weren't allowed to do it. I remember Stevie Claridge came off the bench one day, and as a winger, what you had to do, a right winger like Stevie Claridge, as we know, Stevie Claridge always wanted to drop his left shoulder, come on his right, get a shot off or cross it. This one day is going down the right wing. You weren't allowed to come inside, by the way. Down the outside all the time. Down the outside. Dropped his right shoulder, came inside, beat his man, had a shot on goal, made the keeper make a save. Brilliant. Fans. Hey, well done, Stevie. Off. 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 Honestly, he got brought on and brought off because he went inside.
Wow. So
it was absolutely seething. Seething.
How do you think it would have gone if you got to the playoffs, you lost to Leicester in the playoffs? What do you think it would have been like, that Cambridge team in the Premier League?
I think we would have held our own for a little while.
Yeah.
And then had to change. But I think the initial shock to the big league of us being in there and playing the way we played, I think we'd have had some success. Because how do you handle this? How can you keep doing it and not change? We know what you're doing. But if you know what you're doing and you get it right, there's no way to stop it.
Do you remember? I remember you were like a big name. And there was fuss around you before you moved to Man U. And I remember this because I remember Cambridge playing Plymouth, and this would have been in what is now the Championship. And I remember it was a Tuesday night game, and I remember getting your autograph on my programme. And I was so excited. I remember there was huge fuss. I was like, that guy's going to be apparently going to be a big deal. And he was. Do you remember me?
You like small little ginger guy. That's mental. That's crazy, man. That's amazing. Was that at Plymouth?
It was at Home Park, yeah.
Wow.
I think you won 1-0. And it would have been presumably the season you made the playoffs, or was it? Did you say a season after the playoffs as well?
Yes, because the Wembley appearance against Chesterfield was 1990.
Yeah.
And then I think it was 91.
Right.
It was 91, and then 92 I went to United.
Like Josh says, there was such a big deal of fuss around you. You actually had a choice. You had, was it Chelsea, Everton, and Man United to choose from? So were they all courting you?
Well, I went to speak to all of them. I went to speak to all of them. So there was geographically, obviously, I went Chelsea first, and then I went to Everton, I went to United. So I went down to Chelsea first, and Ian Porterfield was a manager. Went straight to Stamford Bridge. He had an office at Stamford Bridge. Table of 10, round table of 10. Ooh. Nine members of staff sat there.
What?
One spare seat. That was it. So he's there, he's the head of the table. I turn up, sit in that spare chair. He basically said, over half an hour, 45 minutes, I want to build a team around you. I want you to be my number nine for Chelsea. And I've kind of gone, that's amazing. That's incredible. Wow. Thank you very much. I'll get back in touch with you. Went up the M6 straight to Everton, spoke to Howard Kendall, God rest his soul, and chatted to him. He went straight to the fridge at the training ground. The champagne. Honestly, poured the champagne and said, there you go, big man, there you go. Cheers, good to see you, pal. And he said, Dion, I need you to come to Everton. We haven't got a centre forward like you. I want to build a team around you. Fantastic, great. Thank you very much, sir. Appreciate it. I'll let you know. Then I went to Old Trafford. Now, this is the difference between Sir Alex Ferguson, psychologically, and most and any other manager that I've ever met or any other manager I know about. Sir Alex Ferguson said to the agents, you lot go and just talk. Just go and talk. Go upstairs and do... I'll speak to the big man. So just me and him. He put his arm around me. He walked me through the main stand, under the main stand, through the laundry, everything, through the canteen, the lot. And back then, the tunnel where he came out was in between the dugouts, right in the centre of the pitch. He took me through there, came out through the tunnels. I've seen this stadium just appear. I've gone up the bank at Old Trafford and walked down the centre line to the centre spot. So he took his arm off me. He walked out the centre circle and he sort of shouted to me while I was in the centre spot on my own, "How do you fancy playing here once a fortnight?"
Oh, nice. Oh, wow.
Were you looking around going, where's the Quality Street sign?
Why is it the grass lying in the corners? What's going on? And you know what? It's like, back then it was the bowl. It was a 50,000-seater stadium. Yeah. And it is just, unfortunately for the rest of the team, it's a no-brainer. Man United, very clever man.
And £1 million. What was the difference? Did it feel like a huge change from John Beck to Alex Ferguson?
It must have taken me a good, no exaggeration, 3, 4, even 5 months to settle down, to realise where I was. Because when you first go in your first training session and you sit down and you sit next to Paul Ince and Brian Robson and Mark Hughes and Gary Paris and Steve Bruce and Peter Schmeichel, I'd only seen him on the TV. I'm playing with these guys, walking out onto the training pitch. It's like, and what happens every time you get, well, in my era, when you sign for a new football club, you always get tested.
Yeah.
And there's always one midfield player that will always bobble a ball into you or ping it really hard and say, let's see how good you are. Then you come to Man United, let's see how good you are. I've got Big Pally behind me, kicking lumps out of me in training. And Keane is bobbling these balls in to me and I'm thinking to myself, Brian Robson's chipping it in, make it smash and all that kind of stuff. But I'm holding it up. I'm really working hard. That's when they gain your trust. That's when they can go past their midfield player and gamble. When they've got your trust, oh, we can do it, so I can play my natural game. So that's when the trust happened at Villa with Steve Staunton. Same thing.
There's a lot of hard men in that Man U team. You're Brian Robson. Peter Schmeichel's an intimidating figure. Bruce and Pallister. Paul Ince, obviously. If there was a fight between the Man U team you joined and the Cambridge team you left, who are you backing?
I'm going to Cambridge United all day long.
Really?
All day long. Deshi'll deal with four. That only leaves Man United outnumbered. So we had good scrappers. Mark Hughes was a very
of course, as well.
He was a silent, hard man. Then, like you mentioned, the seniors there, Pally would never back down. Brucey was a hard man as well. So yeah, we had some very very good world class players, but below the surface as well. If it kicked off. It kicked off once, which was very, very memorable, by the way.
What was that? Oh, yeah, was that the Arsenal one?
Oh, no. That was... This never got out. Never got out, right? But I'm going to tell you... This is an
exclusive. Oh, wow.
To your podcast. This never got out. Won the league in 1992.
Yeah.
Brian Robson organised a trip to Chester Races. So we go to Chester Races... Have a great day, blah 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 blah. We're all pissed. This is like the end of a week celebration of the, you know, been on our open top bus and we're lagging now. Drinking is not a problem. We've had 6 days of it. Seventh day doesn't matter. Not even touching us. So we go to the races. We have a great day at the races, and then we go out in Chester. Now I don't remember the hotel, but I remember going into this hotel, and there's like two sweeping staircases that goes to a balcony. And underneath the top of the balcony is where you go into the bar area. So it's a big old hotel, but it had bar area, nightclub area and stuff. We walk into this, Eric's there, Schmeichel's there, Ince is there. We walk in and we realise that there was Liverpool fans about. Liverpool fans realised it was Man United that had come in. So they started spitting on us.
Oh, man.
Eric's got the shortest fuse in the world. And Eric's gone like, looked up there, and that's it. Ran back. And you've got Man United players running back towards the front door, up the stairs. It's like a cowboy fight.
Oh, man.
It's like a cowboy fight. Me and Sharpie ended up chasing some fans down the road. We ended up fighting outside, me and Sharpie, with these two guys. I'm getting chimney, getting chimney, I'm getting chimney. Like, honestly, we had this ball for about 2 or 3 minutes. And then we all turned up. We said, look, we better go because it's not going to be great. And we went to another bar and people are watching. They cut some bruises and stuff. So that's what happened when we're out in Chester.
Wow. And it never came out?
Well, until today.
Wow. Amazing. You mentioned Eric Cantona there. Obviously, when you first joined Man United, you're in the team, but then you break your leg in September and you're out for a long time. And in that time, Eric Cantona signed. What a frustrating start, really.
Well, the start was great because my Old Trafford start was terrible, but my start was great because I scored at Southampton on my very first game. We played Southampton on the Monday. We travelled to Southampton on the Sunday, overnight, game on the Monday. I missed the flight on the Sunday. Not great start with Sir Alex
Ferguson. How did you miss the flight?
Because they said, listen, what we'll do, we'll meet at, I don't know, half 12, meet at half 12, we'll fly down. Where would you go? If they said to you, we'll meet at half 12, where would you go as a Man United player?
Old Trafford.
The stadium.
Old Trafford. I went to Old Trafford. They got picked up somewhere else, but I didn't know this. Anyway, They went, long story short, they went on the Sunday. I flew Monday morning and got dog abused by the lads. They threw bread buns at me at pre-match. Yo, big time now, eh? Sophie United. And then he said to me, Dion, you're going to be starting tonight. You know, you've got the number 7 shirt. Don't know if you knew that. But I had the number 7 shirt, which was history in itself. And then I played and we won the game 1-0. And that's how my sort of career started. I thought to myself, I've repaid the manager, missed the flight, scored the goal, won 1-0. And then I'm pretty sure we played either Sheffield United or Forest. And then my very first game at Old Trafford, about 60 minutes in, remember it was clear as day, ball got played out to me, centre circle, Man United's half, received the ball, went to turn away. And as I went to turn away, my left foot was still in the ground. And everything moved but my ankle. Because I had a scissor tackle from behind. Eric Young. Yeah, big Welsh geezer. Had the the ninja headband on. He was called the ninja. He fucking got me that day, the bastard. and it was that was it, really. Pure pain. Dislocated my tib. Broke my fib. That was it. And then they signed some French geezer from Leeds. Who was that?
No way back, man.
To it, I'm afraid. Because they had Eric, Mark Hughes, Brian McClair, Scholes, who was a centre-forward back then, and then there was me. No way back for me, really.
One of the players you mentioned is Mark Hughes. One thing that's come up on this podcast a lot is things people always used to say about Mark Hughes was that he was a specialist at volleying the ball.
Correct.
We didn't realise this was such a thing that one player could be a specialist in. Why was he so good at the ball in the air?
Because most training sessions, you would have Brian Kidd, who was there.
Yeah.
Brian Kidd's a left footer, which makes a difference when I explain. He'd go on the left wing and he would cross 20, 30 balls for Sparky to the edge of the D, outswingers, and Sparky would have to let him come across his left shoulder and volley with his right. That was his favourite volley.
A bit like that Paul Scholes corner routine.
Absolutely. Great striking off the bar.
Yeah.
And Sparky was the forte at that. And he would stay out for a good half an hour, 40 minutes, just doing that.
Wow.
Just volleying all the time. Too high, he'd go on his side and he'd volley it on the side. He perfected it. He perfected how to strike the ball, coming over his left shoulder onto his right. And that's how you become good. And at the other end, at the cliff, behind the goal at the cliff was the gym. So there was a wall behind the goal. So it was a perfect place to practice your free kicks.
Yeah.
If you miss, the ball just hits the wall and comes straight back to you. So Dennis Irwin, Bex, Giggs and Eric were at the other end with another keeper.
Wow. And they were just all staying behind.
Repetition all the time. So I just started to copy what Mark Hughes did. I thought, I better practice my heading. And I did. He just copied the leaders.
At the end of your Man U career in December 93, there's Everton agreed to buy you, and then it's about to go through. A director vetoes it, and Kendall resigns over this. What was your kind of role within all this? How did you hear about this?
I did hear about it, and I think it was I was ready. I was happy, and I spoke to Howard beforehand, and he said, "Dion, I want to do the second time. I think of trying. Second time of trying." And he said, yeah, great. And then the hierarchy said, no.
Did you get another glass of champagne?
I think it was Prosecco this time, to be honest. They lost a few quid to his Prosecco. So he said, yeah, I want you. I said, yes, okay, that's cool by me. And then I think the second time they tried to get me, he was so upset that he resigned. He resigned and said, listen, if you're not going to back my judgment, I'm out of here, man. I'm out of here.
How did you feel?
I felt gutted for him because it would have been a great move for me as well. Would have been a great move for me. And he was wholeheartedly, you know, if somebody tries to get you twice, it's like, wow. And then he said, no, not gonna do it. And then he binned it. He said, no, forget it then.
But it means you moved to Coventry, which is a good club to join, particularly at the time. 2 million fee. So you've doubled in value in your time at Man U with your broken leg.
I was going to mention it, but I'm glad you did.
How was it swapping Alex Ferguson for Phil Neal?
Different, because Phil Neal is possibly, alongside Gordon Strachan, Phil Neal's the best five-a-side and eight-a-side player in training I've ever seen in my life.
Really?
Even at that?
Even at that age. But having played for Liverpool and won everything that he won, all he did is just keep the ball. He never gave it away.
Yeah.
We were under so much pressure, but he'd just bounce it and then get the 1-2. And we, God, how do you do that? It's because his first touch was that good. He bought himself so much time, you know. Yeah. And just, he was amazing. Gordon Strachan was the opposite. I was fast and quick. Everything's got to be quick. And Gordon Strachan was great at it as well.
Yeah.
But that's just the quality of player that we were coached by.
Yeah.
And that's why we got better. Phil Neal was great. Didn't last too long, unfortunately. And then I think Ron.
Big Ron. Yeah.
Yeah, Ron came in, which was completely different.
What was that like?
What's the difference?
Completely different. Ron was, you know, we know about Ron. He's got the bracelets on and, you know, collars up and just bulbs in today. All right, lads, how's it going? Yeah. And we play eight sides. And Ron, you know, he was a little bit chunky, the gaffer back then. He was a little bit chunky. And what he would do, Gordon Strachan would go out there because he was coach. He'd go out, Gordon, and he would put on this session. He would put the cones out. He'd be there at half eight. Eight aside over there, keep ball over there, running session over there, weights over there. It was just meticulous. Everything was, the cones had a distance between them. Every cone had a distance, ready to go. Everything, bibs are out, the lot. Came out, Ron Atkinson, do the warm-up. Ron Atkinson would come out. He'd come out, he'd have his Predators on. Remember the Predators were a little bit?
Yeah.
He'd have Predators on, his shorts, socks rolled down, and he'd say, right, let's have an eight-a-side. And Gordon's gone, Gaffer, I've done. Come on. And he'd kick the cones away and he'd say, come on. Let's have an eight-a-side. And before the game started, he went, I'm going to be Ginola today. I'm going to be Ginola. And he would shout out, find your best player. And that's what he was like. He was just eight-a-side. He was just very sort of chilled out. He was very much a man manager. He knew how to speak to players. He knew how to make you feel $1 million. He knew how to get the best out of the person. Whereas Gordon was the coach, he'd get the best out of the player.
Was that the most fun you had playing under Ron?
Loads of fun playing under Ron. I like boundaries. I like a way of working when it comes to football. Freedom on the pitch, but I don't like, you know, if you have to come to work and I've got this T-shirt on, everybody has to wear this T-shirt. I don't want a blue T-shirt or a yellow T-shirt. Everybody has to wear it. If you're on there at 12:30, get there at 12:20. You know, that was my mindset. And it was the mindset of Gordon, the mindset of Georgie Boateng and Gary McAllister and Roland Nielsen, you know, all these... Yeah. Proper players, you know, that is possibly one of the strongest dressing rooms. Not so much the, you know, physical element, but just the mentality of it and the quality that we had. That's one of the strongest I've ever been in, without a doubt.
Yeah, you know, I mean, some of the characters you name there, throw into that Noel Whelan, John Solarco, Darren Huckabee.
Yeah.
I want to pick up on Noel Whelan. We've interviewed a few ex-Coventry City players and Noel Whelan's name comes up a lot. Was he a bit mad?
Yeah, he was. He was. Noel Whelan's nickname was Snowy. Whichever club he went to, he settled well. And that's just what it was. Snowy's best pal at the club was Paul Telfer. Now, Paul Telfer, the right back, he was like perpetual motion. He would just... It doesn't matter. You could have been on the night out with Paul Telfer the night before. Could have been steaming on the night out. We won on the Saturday. We're out Saturday night. Sunday, he would just be drinking. Bam. Next morning. Doesn't matter. He had no weight on him whatsoever. He was just incredible. Incredibly fit. Unfortunately, Snowy wasn't that way. Noel Whelan couldn't do it. He could do the drink, but he couldn't do the training. On this particular night, they went out for a few beers in Leamington Spa and had a few beers. It's now late. It's early morning, 1-2 in the morning. There's a place called The Parade in Leamington Spa where all the shops are and a couple of bars and stuff. Snowy decides to do something really stupid. And this is what he did a lot. Anything to make him look hard, he would try and do. He tried to kick a window in. You know those big, massive, you know what I mean?
Like double glazed, like
massive windows, you know, WAC, blah, blah, blah. I don't know what window it was, but he kicked it and he wouldn't go in. And he kept trying. Unfortunately, he got through this window in the end, put his foot through the window. So this is the bottom of his foot. He put through the window and went down. And it just, his Achilles just went.
Oh.
That was it. And he didn't realize that he'd done it. And he feared his foot was all warm and it was just squelching and all this kind of stuff.
Oh my God.
He'd done his Achilles operation, rehab. Gordon Strachan said, listen, you are coming to live with me, Gordon Strachan. This is a true story. You're coming to live with me. I need to keep an eye on you. I want you in by 10 every night. You're not going anywhere until you're better. Rehab with me. I don't trust you. All right, Gaffer, no problem. So on this particular night, sat in Gordon's lounge, Snowy's watching the TV thinking, he said, Gaffer, can I go to the cinema? Is it okay to go to the cinema? He said, well, where do you want to go? Just Leamington, you know, just Leamington where the Tenpin Bowling is. No problem at all. But make sure you're back after the cinema. No problem, boss. So he goes to the cinema, out. Gordon saying to his wife, should we go to the cinema? Not knowing where Snowy was going, so they go to the same cinema. Snowy's at the front, right at the front. Gordon's at the back of the lower part of the cinema. And he's at the back and he's gone like that. Gordon sat with his missus there and he's gone, hey, I think that's Snowy down there. I'm going to say hello. So Snowy sat at the front of the cinema like this. Gaffer goes down, he goes, Snowy. Goes like that. Snowy is sat with the goalkeeper's missus.
No. Oh, my God. Oh, no.
So Snowy now sat with the goalkeeper's missus. The gaffer's gone, fucking hell, that's that. Yo, Gaffer, you know, it's not like that, Gaffer, it's not like that. No, you home. It's not like that. Gaffer, let me explain. No. What the gaffer didn't know is that the goalkeeper's missus had a twin sister. Twin's sister? The gaffer went,
no way.
Honestly, True story. Absolutely.
Wow.
Mental.
Oh my God, that's
nothing
incredible.
Nothing wrong at all. He just let me explain.
let's talk about a different gaffer. So, because you play for England under Glenn Hoddle, make your debut under Glenn Hoddle. If Phil Neal was the best eight-a-side player, we've heard from a few people that Glenn Hoddle in training was a bit of a show-off with his skills. Is that fair to say?
He was a show-off without realising that he was that.
Right, yeah.
So he wasn't intentionally showing off. He was just that good. He made everybody else look really poor.
Yeah.
Even to this day, I don't know if the gaffer was left-footed or right-footed. I have no idea.
Was he just the most talented player you could...
Yeah, he was just... When it comes to two-footed players, he's... Him and Dennis Irwin, I don't know what foot Dennis Irwin kicks with because he took penalties left and right, free kicks left and right.
Yeah.
I don't know. The reason why I know that the gaffer's left and right footed and I still don't know is because after training on England duty once, we were all sat on the pitch with John Gorman doing stretches on the pitch. And I think the keeper, might be Nigel Martin, had got injured. So he pulled Shaka Hislop from the 21s into the squad because they were checking on Nigel's fitness. I think it was Nigel.
Yeah.
And while we're doing our stretches, Shaka's there and the gaffer's just pinging balls into him. He's got 10 balls on the corner of the D on the right and 10 balls on the corner of the D on the left. And the gaffer's just, and he's got a few in the middle. So he's pinging the ones down the middle. So Shaka's warming up, catching him, bam, bam, bam. And then he said, well, I'm going to try and bang him in the corners now, Shaka. And the gaffer went from the D, top corner, from the D, top corner. Shaka's diving about, mate. He's diving up. He's waving to his family in the crowd. Hello. Hello. He's getting nowhere near these free kicks at all. And Glenn's just popping him in the corner, tapping his toe down, banging it in the corner, toe down. And it was just, we were like this. Oh, no. It was just, Shaka's trying to get this. He can't get there. Gaff was outstanding.
It's amazing, isn't it? Did he ever discuss with you that he was one of the main critics of John Beck when he was the Swindon manager? Did that ever come up?
No way, I never knew that.
Yeah, when I was reading up on Cambridge, obviously, Cambridge's style, one of the main critics was Glenn Hoddle, as you can imagine.
Yeah, well, he was at Swindon for a while, wasn't he, Glenn?
Yeah, when he was at Swindon, yeah.
And I think we played against Swindon a couple of times, and I think we may have beaten them physically, beat them up, and we may have beat them by the scoreline as well, so that's probably what he didn't like. And I think he was frustrated because John Beck was a player back in the day. When he was at John Beck was a player like Glenn Hobb, nowhere near the standard.
Yeah.
He used to pass and get it back, and he was amazing.
It's often the way with that. It's like George Graham was a very silky player, yeah. And then he'd go...
It happens. It's just maybe you can coach better that way, you know?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, 97, 98, 18 league goals for Coventry City. Mm. Just in outstanding form, and obviously you're in the long list for the World Cup squad, but infamously, yourself and Gazza are two of the people that are cut. What are your memories of that day, those conversations with Glenn Hoddle in the hotel room?
Vivid. Very vivid.
Really?
Gazza was in there before me.
So was it all smashed up when you went in?
Yeah, it was. It was.
Oh, mate.
Oh, man.
Because it was Incy, me, Gazza. And we were all sat in the hallway of a hotel. Our rooms are opposite each other, but we all sat in the hallway because we were just chatting and just thinking, what are you going to get through? What are you going to get through? Incy went in first, and then I get up to go. Incy comes out, I get up to go. Gazza said, Dee, hey, can I go, big man? I can't wait any longer. You're not Gazza, patient. He just wants to get stuff done. He goes in, and obviously, you know, things didn't go well, and the gaffer said, obviously, you're not going. And we heard a bit of crash, bang, wallop. Glenn Roeder, God rest his soul, he went in there as well. John Gorman went in there, and it was all over the place. Gazza comes out, he's sobbing, you know, he's just...
Oh, man. You were outside the door. You were hearing this unfold.
Yeah. Right. On everything outside. Oh, so, man. You know, plant pot sitting against the wall and all that kind of stuff. And he was just demoed because he knew that was it. You know, that was the Gazza. He was the best player at that time, naturally, bar none. He really was. And the gaffer he said no. And it's like, wow, what a decision to make that is. I go in and I'm kind of stepping over plant pot, overturned chairs. And...
Oh, my God. Was Kenny G still playing? Because that was apparently one of the calming tactics, wasn't it?
So I go in and I sit opposite the gaffer, and the gaffer's, you know, he just said, listen, Dee, sorry about what happened, sorry about the state of the room, but I'm going to be straight with you. He said, listen, this is the hardest decision. I've got to tell you sincerely, this is the hardest decision for me. Not the Gazza one, yours, because I've got a 7.5. I've got two players in one. However, I need more pace going as a centre forward. Obviously, I wasn't the quickest. So he ended up taking Les over me, which I didn't mind, to be fair, because, you know, he is Sir Les in our eyes. And he took Les instead. So myself, Gazza, Butty, Phil Neville, Andy Hinchcliffe, and I think it was Ian Walker.
And are you all then on a plane together back?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
You get picked, you go right. You don't get picked, you go left.
Oh, mate.
So you go left, go left. Six of us go left. There's a people carrier waiting, literally engine running all up there already. Well, because everybody had to pack their bags because nobody knew. Nobody knew.
Yeah.
So bags are in, and then in a people carrier, Gazza's just crying. He was just, Gazza was demoed. We were all just trying to look after Gazza. We kind of accepted it. I actually said to the gaffer, listen, I appreciate it, gaffer. I had a great time. Thank you very much for picking me. I wish you all the best. They were kind of the words I said. And then, you know, we had to sort of deal with Gazza because he was an emotional wreck at the time. And yeah, hard to deal with Gazza. It really was.
Oh, but did you not think of the injustice? Like, you scored 18 league goals for Coventry. You'd been on fire that whole year.
I know, yeah. There was... Obviously, when the World Cup starts, you think, you know. I mean...
Did you watch it?
Yeah, I was in San Pedro, Estepona, Port Benus area at the time. And I remember going to Port Benus because Stevie Watson, I think... Remember Stevie Watson played for...
Yeah, Newcastle.
Newcastle and stuff. He was there, and I think Tomo was there, Alan Thompson, left-footed Alan Thompson. And I think we were all in a bar. And we didn't know we were in the same area. We went to the bar, and watched the game. Yeah, and I was just having a beer rather than having a milkshake, you know what I mean? It was devastating. When it started, that's when it really hit home.
That could have been you that scored that Michael Owen goal. In another world, that was you that skinned your way through the Argentina team
and pinged it in the top corner. Raced
I wanted Michael to go wide and cross it, and then I'd have headed it.
It's Aston Villa is where you go from Coventry. So that was autumn 1998, 5.75 million.
It's always increasing in value. Yeah.
Some big money. That's homes under the hammer to a T, isn't it? Always increasing. Well, once you get Dion Dublin, you just, you know, flip him and sell him on for a bit more. That's how it works.
The older it gets, the more value will get you back, mate. Simple as that. So, as long as you're patient, you'll be okay. It was a strange one because the chairman at the time was, gosh, I forget his name.
Doug Ellis?
No. I'm talking about the Coventry chairman.
Oh, Coventry chairman. I don't know.
Anyway, the Coventry chairman wanted me to go to Blackburn. I suppose he went back and Gordon said, listen, Dion, I've got a new contract for you. Are you happy? Yes, Gaffer. 4 years? Yes, Gaffer. Give you a pay rise? Brilliant, Gaffer. I'll sign. This is what we said. And then the chairman wanted me to go to Richardson, his name was, wanting me to go to Blackburn for 6.7. I've gone, no, I'm happy. I'm okay. I'm fine, thank you. He said, I want you to go to have a chat with Blackburn. I said, don't want to go. Long and short of it is I didn't go to Blackburn. Ended up going to Villa for 5.7. And the fans are thinking, oh, I can't believe he's gone to our rivals. But they didn't know that I'd, you know, turned down Blackburn. I'd organised a four-year deal with Gordon Strachan, word of mouth. And it went a bit ugly in the end. And the chairman was saying this and the chairman was saying that. He only wants to go to for Villa to make a few quid and all that kind of stuff. So it got a bit ugly.
God. Yeah.
That was unnecessary. And then I ended up going to Villa. John Gregory took me to Villa.
What was John Gregory like? He looked like a lot of fun.
John was exactly that. He was exactly that. John was a lot of fun. Very chilled out manager. He had an edge to him, but yeah. As a bloke, loved his music, so he was always playing the guitar. He loved Springsteen.
Always, yeah.
guitar in his office at the training ground. He'd always playing his guitar. And he was very relaxed. I loved John Gregory because he used to give me loads of time off. Absolutely loved it. We'd play on a Saturday. I'd say, I'll see you Wednesday, big man. Thank you very much, boss. And I'm getting a bit older now, and I'd go. I had a place in Spain then, so I'd go to Spain for 3 or 4 days and come back on,
or
whatever it was, and train. But no, it was again the quality that we had at Villa, the quality we had along with Man United in regards to the players, the individuals, was possibly one of the highest we had, with Paul Merson, Gareth Southgate, Ginola, Peter Schmeichel, David James, the quality of player. Then you have the kids that we used to call the kids, Gareth Barry, Crouchy, Darius Vassell, Lee Hendry, you know, James Samuel, God rest his soul, my very good friend, but he was there too. So many, Hugo Ekiod, God rest his soul again. Why have I lost so many people? That's what upsets me, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Young kids as well. But the quality was like, wow.
Yeah, that's a hell of a squad, isn't it?
We won the Intertoto Cup.
Yeah,
that's
great.
Hey.
You took Villa to their first FA Cup final in 43 years, the last at Wembley, isn't it, in 2000. I wondered, what kind of state was Wembley in at that point, right at the end there?
It was still, because it was Wembley, it was still, you know, it's very much like Old Trafford is now. Old Trafford needs to be, you know, refreshed. It needs a few quid spending on it. But they know that, and they've got to do it at the right time. Wembley at that time was the same. It still held this, wow, it's Wembley. When you walk out of that tunnel, you're in an FA Cup final against Chelsea. It was the worst FA Cup final in history. It was terrible. Full house, they beat us 1-0. I think Di Matteo might have scored the goal. And it was, you know, the build-up was great, the game wasn't great, and then we had a massive party afterwards. We were just awful, to be honest with you.
Oh, mate.
It was an awful game.
Well, let's focus on one very quick positive before we go to our listeners' questions, which is people say you didn't play in a major international tournament, but they forget the King Hassan II International Cup. Do you wake up at night regretting that France beat England to the trophy on goals scored?
I actually, in that competition, played against, I think it was Belgium. I think it was England versus Belgium. I came off the bench as a centre-half, and I played against two twins called the Impenza twins.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember.
They all had the braids, and they were lively as anything, and I came on and had to mark them at centre-half. So I played centre-half and centre-forward for England in the King Hussein Cup, let me tell you. And the cap that I've got has got the King Hussein Cup on it as well, let me tell you.
Oh, wow.
It's a very important tournament.
It is.
Yeah.
course it is.
At home next to your Intertoto Cup, is that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. they are, listen, little things like those little memories and stuff that you never forget that sort of, I don't know, it's stuff that you remember and never forget, and the achievements that you have, albeit Intertoto Cup, third division playoffs, all those things, I will never, ever forget them, because when I was nine, back to the start, when I was nine, none of that was possible back then. 22 years as a pro, 14 operations. So, you know.
And a broken neck as well. I remember it was in the paper, when that happened, it was in the papers like, your career was over, it seemed like. Yeah. 3 months later, you're back. How does that even work?
I don't know. I genuinely don't know how it works. And here they went through there. I've got a scar, and they went through the front of my neck there, so I didn't have a scar at the back of my neck. So how it happened was I break my neck on the pitch. Long story short, I break my neck. I go off. The physio says, "Right, Dion, you something's wrong." I said, "No, I'm okay. I'm okay." And I've insisted, "I'm okay. No, Jim, I'm okay." Jim Walker knows the situation, right? And he knows he'll be off in 15 seconds. So I run back on the pitch, straight back off again. Jim says, get off. So I come off, they put a hard board behind my back. So I'm stood up and they put a hard board and then they just lower me back onto a golf cart. This must have taken 15 minutes. Game's finished. I'm still getting my head and chin and everything strapped to this hardball. So
Oh my word.
And then they lower me back onto the golf buggy. Because the whistle's gone, I can go directly, diagonally across the pitch, straight behind the goal, up the hill into the first aid area. So I've gone there. I thought Villa Park was like a carpet. When you've broken your neck and you're going across it in a buggy, your head's like that. Not as fast as I thought. So this is what happened. Jim McGregor diagnosed me, took me across golf buggy into the back. And then I've got Dr. Barry Smith. And I'm on this hardboard, and it's very, very painful at the time. And I've been there for 35 minutes, 40 minutes, 50. I said, "Doc, come on, Doc, I'm in some pain here." He said, "Dion, I cannot allow you to go to hospital until I find Mr. Andre Jakowski. I can't allow you to have operation until I find this surgeon." And he rang and he rang and he rang. And then he got Mr. Andre Jakowski, who was a young Polish, I think he was Polish, young, 43, 33. I don't know what he was, but he was young. He was a lot younger than me. And I'm thinking, wow. And I'm now thinking, "Doc, please." And he said, "I found him, hospital, bam, there you go." So Jim Walker got me on the board. Dr. Barry Smith made sure that I had the only surgeon that he would allow me to get operated by. Dr. Andre Jakowski operated on me. Cut me open here. I crushed C5. So C5 is there. So 4 and 6 were touching. So they lifted 4 and 6. They cut me on the hip, took some bone off my hip, built a new 5, put them together, and then put a plate in, which sort of went screw there, screw there, screw there, and screw there. And that's still in here now, the metal plate.
Oh, wow.
So that's it. It's titanium, so it doesn't beep when I go through the airport.
that's useful. I mean, what a career. It's been an absolute joy, Dion, genuinely. I've never known an interview where I've thought none of this is going to be edited out. This is all it. We always end with the same question, gold. Which is, if you go back to 1990, January the 1st, and press a button to do it all again, would you?
Yes, I would. I would. Yeah. I would, because you've got to be lucky enough to be able to... One of the biggest period in the whole of my career was the time you sign on the dotted line as a professional. It's very, very odd that the paper I signed was pink. I was at Norwich City and I signed this piece of paper, and it meant that I was getting £80 a week I was 17, and you've just turned pro. That means you haven't got to work anymore. All you got to do is turn up for training and just kick a ball about. That was it. And let me tell you this before I go. So I signed for Norwich City, and my brother, Ash, he's a DJ in Great Yarmouth, quite a big DJ in Great Yarmouth. And he lived above a bar in Great Yarmouth. That's where he lived, above a pub. The nightclub was next door where he worked, but he lived above a pub called Boobs on the seafront on the seafront in Great Yarmouth. So I'm living with my brother. And my brother, his best mate, was a drummer. Right, my brother's a bass player, so they played the same band. He happened to be a model and he happened to be a highboard diver for Great Britain. Now an A-list star. He's an A-list film star. He wasn't then, but he is now. So I lived for 8 months with my brother and Jason Statham.
No way!
Come on!
That is incredible.
It was mental because my brother on a Saturday night, I've had a game on the Saturday, I'm going out as Jason Statham's sidekick. It was crazy. I mean, he was the same, completely chiseled, good bloke, good bloke.
Oh, Dion, it's been an absolute joy. Thank you so much for doing it.
It's a pleasure, guys. Listen, it's been good fun. Sorry it's taking so long, I apologise.
Oh, but... no, it's been a joy. Thanks so much.
Pleasure, guys. Thank you. Take care.
There we go, Dion Dublin. If you want more of that, go to anotherslice.com/quicklykevin. There's more where that came from. Quick quiz before we end?
Let's do it.
Okay. In honour of that quiz, we're going to, in honour of the Roger Miller fact earlier, we're going to do a quick game of starting 11. Cameroon versus England, 1990. Do you remember the score? 3-2 to England?
Yeah.
Yeah, obviously. How are you feeling about that as a fixture, guys?
Good with England.
Fairly strong about England. Yeah, Cameroon. I think maybe three. Two and a punt.
Well, remember you can't have subs as well, so Miller is out of the equation.
Well, you can to buy time.
You can to buy time. Okay, Michael, if you'd like to start.
I will start with Gary Lineker, please.
Correct.
Roger Miller.
Well, no, that here's a sub.
Of course. Oh, my God, we've just established that. In that case...
Unbelievable.
Right, in that case, I can't touch Cameroon. Do I get to go again?
Yep.
Peter Beardsley.
Lost a life. Absolutely. What? Absolutely. One of the worst performances I've ever seen. Oh, wait, he came on.
Oh, I was going to say, I vaguely remember him playing, but...
He came on for John Barnes. So, once again, Skull. It's still you.
So I got another chance. Paul Parker.
Correct.
Peter Shilton.
Correct.
Oh, God. The Waddler.
Correct.
Des Walker.
Correct.
Mark Wright.
Correct.
David Platt.
Correct.
Stuart Pearce.
Correct. Just two England players left, then we'll move on to Cameroon.
John Barnes.
Correct. Three England players left. Now there's two.
Oh, God. Two left. Oh, God, who have we had? Well, can you tell me the position?
Yeah, defence and midfield.
Tony Dorigo?
Incorrect. Michael?
I'm not sure of England, so I'm going to go for Francis Omambiek.
Correct.
Oh, who have we missed out?
Paul Gascoigne.
Oh my God, that is shocking.
And Terry Butcher.
How have we missed out? Guess couldn't see the wood for the trees.
Absolute real shame. There we go. Thank you for listening. Absolute shambles. Thank you for listening. If you want more Dion Dublin, or more importantly, next week's episode without adverts now, head over to anotherslice.com/quicklykevin for the Quickly Kevin fan club. Maisie Adam joins us and we review two very contrasting documentaries about Sheffield United and Sheffield Wednesday throughout the 90s. Incredible stuff about how Ron Atkinson prepares his team for a cup final. That is over there now. But well, Michael, how would you like to end music-wise?
Two options. If it exists, I'm going to play in some audio footage of Dion Dublin on the Dube. If it doesn't exist, then I will pick World in Motion.
Well, there's only one way to find out. Here it is.
Lovely. That's it for this week. We'll see you next week. Until then, Stuart Slater. See you later.